This is Talking to America. I'm your host, Aaron Zellin. Our subject today is the law. We're talking to Richard Stevens, lawyer and author, a longtime contributor of articles and materials for books, booklets, and films about freedom, government, civilian disarmament, and the Bill of Rights. Richard, some people say that Americans need to clean house in Congress. They say that America can return to a free, non-socialist, prosperous country if we just elect the right people to the House and Senate. Other people say that the real problem is the kinds of laws and the numbers of laws that we have. So my question to you is, what do you think is most dangerous to the American way of life and our liberty? The elected officials in the legislature or the laws themselves?
Well, Aaron, I think that both are dangerous, but the laws are the more dangerous of the two.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we both know people who believe that we should just enforce the laws. I guess the question is, why would they say that, and what do you think about that?
Well, I think that the laws can be the most dangerous thing. Once a law is enacted, at least in our system, once a law is enacted, it usually remains on the books permanently. So, you know, a congressman or senator or president can go to back to private life, retire, pass away, but the law remains in effect. And that's the same, by the way, for judicial decisions. Once a judge has made a decision or a court of appeals, Supreme Court has made a decision, those rulings exist forever, way past the lifetime of the judge. Unless somebody does something about them, they're going to remain there as the law. So when you have laws that reduce liberty or infringe on our rights or raise taxes or affect the economy in a negative way, laws that, you know, damage our ability to defend ourselves either as a nation or as people, then that law is going to continue to do that damage forever. And that's going to go on until it's changed to repeal. There's another element of it. It's not just the law itself, but it's also the effect of this whole system of laws in a country. The system of laws is like an educational system. Every law, statute, regulation, ruling, etc., is part of that system. And we might refer to the whole system as the law, you know, the law meaning the whole system. Well, the law creates an environment. It creates the environment we all are raised in. It trains people to think in a certain way. You know, since we're kids, we know what's, you know, the law says you can't do this, the law says you can't do that. Well, if the law upholds natural rights, if it upholds freedom, if it upholds a free market economy, things like that, then that's one kind of environment, and that happens to be the one America used to have. But if the law tends to give people opportunities to get tax money for their pet projects out of the government, if that's the way the law tends to operate, then that's a different kind of environment. And as the law goes, it teaches the people what kind of situation we live in. And the third thing that's really important about the way the law operates, I think, is that the law, the whole system of laws and regulations and everything, becomes the guidebook. It becomes, you know, as though we're in stone, and all the bureaucrats and government employees and judges and everybody else thinks that that's where the power is, and the government employees just routinely and mechanically apply the law. You know, we've all been in a line, whether it's a Department of Motor Vehicles or a BATF or someplace else, and somebody will tell us, "Well, I don't make the rules; I just follow them." Well, that's the motto of government employees, and that's what the law does. It creates an environment that people feel they can't get outside of, and they can't use any reason outside of. It's just the way things go. So, if the system of laws, which we can refer to as the law, hurts people, harms liberty, then so be it. Government agents and the bureaucrats are going to carry out that law, whether it's good or bad, and whether or not the current Congress even supports it.
It's a frightening situation. Well, I guess some of our listeners would like to know if you can give some examples of how the law rules us more than the lawmakers.
There's one that almost every American knows, and it's good that we know it, but it gives you a sense of how powerful the law is as an educational tool. And that is that people are presumed innocent until proved guilty in our legal system. Little kids even know that, you know, in grade school and high school. And if you're a parent, you may have had conversations like that with a teenager who says, "You can't prove it, I'm still innocent." But the fact is that principle of presumption of innocence controls not only the way criminal trials operate, but it has an effect on the way we think in private life. And similarly, one that everybody knows, certainly everybody over age 18, and that's the idea that the homeowner can deduct mortgage interest on their federal taxes. You know, we say mortgage interest is deductible. And we walk around as though that came off of Mount Sinai. And, you know, mortgage interest is deductible. And you can hardly even discuss a new or revised tax program in this country, whether it's fair tax, flat tax, or any other change. You can't really mention those things without coming up against somebody saying, yeah, but mortgage interest is deductible, right? And people just believe that as a fact. So that mortgage interest is deductible clause, for example, just one part of a huge federal tax code, has become something that everybody believes is true, and it will continue to affect us long after the original legislators and the judges and everybody who initially put it together, long after they're dead and gone.
How about some other examples from world history that you could share?
Well, in America, and if you look at between America and Mexico, for example, and those of us who live in the Southwest are more conscious of this than others. But in America, as I was mentioning before, you're presumed innocent until you're proved guilty. But in Mexico, they don't have that presumption. In fact, the way it operates, it's as though you're presumed guilty until you prove yourself innocent. Well, that's a way, way different system. And that's why Americans who go down to Mexico and get into trouble end up in jail for long periods of time before trial. And it's really hard to understand why it's so easy to get convicted down there. And that's one of the reasons, one of the ways that you can see differences in play. But there are lots worse examples than just that one. For example, in America, we have a notion, I think, that our law says, well, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt somebody else or you don't violate laws. You can do what you want. It's kind of what we call freedom. And that's the spirit in America, even though I think we're losing it in a lot of ways. But in America, you can look at the written laws and you can figure out what's prohibited and what isn't and what the penalties are for violating the law. You know, pretty darn well. It's not perfect, but it's pretty accurate. You can actually look up the law that you're about to break if you really want to do it. But let's turn to Nazi Germany as a perfect example. There's lots of them, but it's one that people know well. In Nazi Germany, the law, the legal system was different. There, the written laws didn't explain everything about the law. They were just guidelines. The written laws were guidelines. This is hard to imagine for Americans. But in Nazi Germany, the judge could convict you of violating the spirit of a law, not the written words. But if you did something that seemed to violate the idea of the law, you could be punished. And not only that, but the written down penalties in the Nazi law were viewed as minimums, not maximums. And, you know, in the United States we say, you know, punishable by 5 years, up to 5 years in prison, things like that. Well, Nazi laws had things like that. But the way their system worked, the judges were encouraged to go beyond the number in the statute. Well, that gives you a sense of how the way the legal philosophy, the way the law operates, can have a vast effect and a horrific effect. And of course, in Nazi Germany, they maximized penalties against Jews and against gun owners and against other enemies of the state. And it went far beyond whatever the German legislation said. It went on all the way to the Holocaust.
You know, there's a lot of information here. Are there any books or resources that you suggest people use?
To have
a better understanding of what you're saying?
Sure. There's a little book. I know you've read this, I've read this, and many of the people you and I know have read, and I recommend it to everyone in America. It's a little book. It's called The Law. The Law, and it's the meaning of the law is the same as we've been using it in this conversation. And that's written by a fellow named Frederick Bastiat, B-A-S-T-I-A-T. I think it's pronounced Bastiat in French, but that doesn't matter. Frederick Bastiat wrote this book called The Law. It's very short. It's extremely easy to read. But it makes very clear what we're talking about when we're talking about the law. Another excellent book, a little harder to get, but really quite good. It's called Nazi Justice, J-U-S-T-I-Z, Nazi Justice. That's written by Richard Lawrence Miller. I believe it's still available. I read that, and I wrote a comprehensive review of that for one of our Bill of Rights Sentinel issues some years ago. And I've also myself written an article recently that talk about how Nazi principles were applied to gun control laws, so-called gun control laws. And that article should be available, too. Another good book is by Paul Craig Roberts. Many people have heard of him and a co-author. He's a nationally syndicated columnist, and his book is called The Tyranny of Good Intentions. It's a relatively current book. It talks about a lot of important concepts that we're talking about here. And another book known to some people, it's still available, by Ludwig von Mises, M-I-S-E-S, von Mises, and it's entitled simply Bureaucracy. Those are all books that if people could sit down and read, none of them is a long book, but people will get a real sense of what we're talking about here.
I can't let you get away with not mentioning The State versus the People.
Oh, of course.
The Rise of the American Police State by Claire Wolfe and myself.
Oh, absolutely.
Not a short book. It's long, but it's only 500 and some pages.
Yeah.
But it tells you more than you ever wanted to know about what's wrong in America.
No, that's a very good book, and it's actually very easy to read, too.
This is Talking to America with our guest, Richard Stevens. Here once again is your host, Aaron Zellman.
Another question I have for you is that there's a vintage song that we hear on the radio occasionally. The refrain is, I fought the law and the law won.
Yeah.
Does that song lyric make any sense with what you're talking about?
Yeah. Again, remember our initial question was, which is more dangerous, the legislature, you know, the Congress and Senate, or the law itself? And that song, I fought the law and the law won, that song explains in a very simple way how we view the law. The law is not, the song is not about I fought the Congress or I fought the judge or I fought the police, but people come to view the whole system of rules and enforcement as the law. So bad guys might see themselves as fighting the law, not an individual, but the whole system. And that's the important thing to point out. For good or ill, the law is a whole system. And that's what I think people need to be most concerned about.
I think it'd be good to clarify something. There might be some people who think that you're against having laws and against having governments. Based on what you're saying, how would you explain that to people?
No, I'm not, in fact, against laws, and I'm not against government. What I am is called a classical liberal. I come from the classical liberal tradition, and that is the tradition that led Thomas Jefferson to write in the Declaration of Independence that the people have unalienable rights, and that the people create the governments to protect those rights, the right to life and liberty and property implicitly there, and also the right of the people to create a legal environment of justice and equality before the law. That's the whole message of the first part of the Declaration of Independence states those views. And that's not an anti-government or anti-law position. That's a pro-government and pro-law position, but it comes from a position of natural rights of man. So I look at it as governments work for the people. People don't work for the government. That's a very American concept, and that's one that I adopt. And I think that laws ought to be enacted that create an environment where the laws are not intrusive. They don't ruin your life. And you also don't have laws that favor one group at the expense of another. I'm looking at a good society as one that sustains harmony, abundance, and self-government. I think the law can do that.
Well, okay, let's shift the focus a little bit. Let's move away from the law and talk about lawmen. Do you tend to support the police, or do you tend to be critical and oppose the police?
You know, that's a really good question. In fact, over the years, I've had to face this one because people have taken some of what I've said as seeming to be anti-police and not at all. I believe the proper function of the law, the system of laws, the law, is primarily to keep the peace. And that's key. Now, keep the peace. Keeping the peace means protecting life, protecting property, protecting liberty of each individual citizen. Keeping the peace, that means deterring aggressors and imprisoning aggressors when you catch them. So I fully support the police as peace officers. Peace officers, that's the word that used to be used all the time. And peace officers keep the peace. Being a peace officer is a very tough job, and I believe, quite frankly, that honest and effective peace officers ought to be paid a lot better than they are in most towns and cities. So, no, I'm not anti-police at all. I'm a pro-peace officer.
Well, you get my vote for that. tell us, how about all of the various law enforcement agencies and their agents? How do they fit into the law?
Well, Aaron, you know, this is going to take a little explaining, but it's something that a lot of people haven't thought about. We've gone through a period of political correctness, and we tend to adopt new language for things. You know, we don't call people trash men. We call them sanitation engineers. You know, we've changed the language over the last 20 or 30 years a lot. And this is what's happened so that people don't understand, I think, what I'm going to say unless I explain it carefully. I'm very suspicious of the concept of law enforcement, the term law enforcement. Every American ought to be concerned about law enforcement, and here's why. when you're keeping the peace as a peace officer, like I was explaining a moment ago, your job is to protect life, liberty, property. You're there to promote the harmony among the people and to catch and put away the bad guys, the guys who kill, steal, injure, damage, defraud, or harass innocent people. That's your job as a peace officer. But now here's the shift. When you're enforcing the law, you have a different mission. Some authority will tell you, as a law officer, what the laws are, and then you go out and make sure people are obeying the laws. See the difference there? A law enforcement agency makes sure people obey. That's a very different message from the one of the peace officer. So now, if you have a system of laws, if the laws are bad, if the laws are unjust, if they deny fundamental human rights, that doesn't make any difference to the law enforcement agency, because that agency's job is to enforce the laws, make people obey. Now, here's an example that this kind of thing happens a lot, especially, again, if you have teenage boys, as I do, things like this come up with them or their friends. Here's a real situation. Supposing you're out shooting targets on private land on some nice Sunday afternoon, and the owner of the land finds out about it and they don't like it, so they call the police, and the local peace officer comes out and he comes up to you, and you're 17 years old and you're out there shooting your 22 if it's legal, and the officer comes up to you and talks to you and finds out you didn't really realize you were not on legal land and it wasn't legal and all that, and you tell him you're the kid, and you tell the peace officer, like, okay, I'll stop, we'll pack up and we'll leave. Well, a peace officer might just thank you and warn you that, look, if you do this again, you could be in some serious trouble, but just don't do it again. Now, that's the model of a peace officer, keeping the peace, making sure you don't violate the property rights of others, but not creating special problems for you either. Just, resolve the problem. But now let's look at the way a law enforcement agent from a federal agency is likely to view this. A law enforcement agent's job is to enforce federal gun laws, for example. Now, that agent gets career credit. He gets points for the number of people he arrests and gets convicted. That's how those people are tracked. That's how you can tell whether you have a successful agent or not, is how many people he's arrested, how many he's gotten convicted. Now, that agent's motivation is not to protect life and property. His motivation is to carry out orders, to catch people who violate the law, and then make sure those people are prosecuted. So, federal agent catches you doing this kind of thing, federal agent now has an opportunity to increase his statistics of how many people he's caught. And he's much more likely to want to bring charges against you for violating some law about firearms, even though you're not endangering anybody or damaging anybody's life or property or any other right. And that's a key thing to understand, the difference between peace officer and law enforcement officer.
Let's turn to a different subject. You and I have been working for several years on the issues of so-called gun control laws. In light of what you've been saying today, how should Americans view so-called gun control laws?
First thing we observe is gun control laws do not protect life, liberty, or property. And remember, the Declaration of Independence talked about protecting the rights of man, the unalienable rights to life and liberty and the things that support that. Well, gun control laws don't do that. Gun control laws don't keep the peace. They don't help protect innocent people against aggressors. Let's look at today, for example, in Louisiana, down in the flooded areas. Now they've apparently suspended the concealed carry laws. They're apparently going house to house to retrieve firearms from people under some notion of gun control. Nobody can show you any evidence that taking away a firearm from somebody who's only going to use that for defense is a good thing. What it means is the bad guys who are not going to be disarmed are going to be armed, while all the innocent people stuck down there in the water are going to be disarmed, and the government is making that happen. That's what gun control laws do generally. And then on a larger scale, gun control laws are a key element of every genocide of which I'm aware in the 20th century. Gun control laws condition the people to consider themselves powerless subjects. They're waiting for the state or waiting for the city or waiting for somebody to take care of them because their tools have been taken away. And, for example, if the New Orleans Police Department or the National Guard can't protect you, you're lost under a gun control notion where they've made sure you can't protect yourself. So I look at gun control laws as simply bad. And not only bad, they're also unconstitutional if you can read the Constitution, if you can read the Second Amendment, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, and the Bill of Rights. Gun control laws are bad laws.
Well, just to clear the air, in case anybody has any doubts at this point, are there any kinds of so-called gun control laws that you favor?
No. No, Aaron, I do not. I oppose all gun control laws. What I do favor, though, are laws that punish criminal violence and misconduct. Everybody does, I think, except the bad guys. So, but that's where the real action is in protecting society, is to protect the peace and punish bad guys who actually commit violent crimes. I also favor laws that forbid convicted violent criminals, and I say violent criminals, from possessing and carrying firearms. Now, that some people call that a gun control law, but it's not a gun control law. What that is a law that imposes an additional penalty upon people who have proved that they're willing to use force to harm other people unjustly. So the prohibition on convicted criminals, as I say, is not a gun control law. It's a penalty for past conduct. I can also accept laws that would set an age limit on the lawful carrying of firearms. For example, you might have a rule against young kids walking around with firearms without permission. But again, the way I would phrase it, such a law would be to punish a parent who allowed a child access to firearms when that child committed an illegal violent act. That's not a gun control law. It's not aimed at the gun. It's a parental responsibility law. It aims at the parent. So those are the kinds of laws that I think make sense because they aim at the actor, not at the tool.
Well, a lot of Americans oppose so-called gun control laws and policies. But I think the big question is, where should they focus their energies? For example, electing different congressmen and senators, getting different judges in the courts, trying to get initiatives passed by the voters in the states, lobbying Congress and state legislators to change the laws. What would you suggest Americans do?
Well, all of those efforts can be useful, but I strongly believe that the American people have to understand gun control laws, so-called gun control laws, for what they are, and they are civilian disarmament laws. We have to understand that gun control is an idea. When you analyze it and look at it, the way it's designed and the way its effects operate, it's designed to maximize the power in the hands of governments and government agents, while it leaves civilians powerless and dependent upon government. That's why, incidentally, the leftist philosophy tends to favor gun control. The left, as a philosophical vision, sees a world run by experts. That's the vision they would like to have in the future. Experts who exercise power to get ordinary people to live according to the way the experts think is best. Now, history of mankind shows that vision leads to all the horrors of authoritarian and totalitarian regimes. But that's what's happening with gun control. So Americans have to understand gun control is a form of oppression. In fact, we have to come to a point where we hate and fear gun control ideas the same way we would hate and fear the vicious ideas of racism or Nazism, communism, and those others. Look at it this way. A person who wants to disarm you when you're facing a dangerous enemy is a person whom you should hate the same way you would hate a rapist or a child murderer. So, answering your original question, the most important effort, I believe, is to move the hearts and minds of the American people, move them to understand what I'm talking about and the danger of gun control as an idea and as a series of laws. And when Americans understand, it'll be a lot easier to change the laws or elect better representatives or get good rulings from the courts.
This is Talkin' to America with our guest, Richard Stevens. Here once again is your host, Aaron Zellman.
You know, one of the projects that you've been helping JPFO with that some people have challenged us on is to examine the gun control laws in Nazi Germany. JPFO has argued that Nazi Germany, the gun control laws were used to disarm the intended victims of genocide. So the first question we should address is that historical claim true?
Yes, that historical claim is true. And when you look back at some of the history that's been unearthed over the last three quarters of a century, you learn that the Nazis began disarming and imprisoning its political enemies in 1933, just after Hitler came to power. They began that. There are news stories in the New York Times, for example, that reported some of the raids and arrests that were already starting to occur. Dr. Stephen Holbrook, a lot of people have heard of him, Stephen Holbrook has written a very comprehensive law review article that documents this fact. And a shortened version of that article, by the way, appears in our book, Death by Gun Control, And Dr. Holbrooke kindly lent that chapter to our book, and it documents it with footnotes and the whole work, so that you can see that the Nazi regime did indeed use gun control laws to disarm its victims. Also, of course, the JPFO book, which came out even before that, called Gun Control: Gateway to Tyranny, provides the full text of the German laws that operated in Germany at that time, with English translations, analysis of the provisions. And, of course, all those books are available at the website, jpfo.org.
There's some confusion amongst people, so we ought to clarify a point. Was it Hitler who imposed gun control laws to disarm the victims?
Yeah, this is an area where people who have argued about and said, you know, the Nazis passed laws to disarm the people. Well, in reality, the truth is, the comprehensive gun control laws that made it possible for the Nazis to disarm the people, those laws were actually enacted 5 years before the Nazis came to power. The comprehensive gun control law was enacted in 1928. And the 1928 laws in Germany had a national firearms registration, a national owner licensing, and lots of other controls. All of those things impaired private ownership and possession of firearms, and also alerted the regime to whoever would own a firearm. They would be on a list, so they would know at the sometime in the future who had firearms and who didn't. And it's a perfect example of how the law lives on and produces bad consequences even when the original legislators are gone. The folks in 1928 might have had really good motives for their national gun control law, but they were gone in 1933, and the Nazis employed the concept of law enforcement to aggressively enforce those existing gun laws on the books, because they were on the books already from 1928, against Germans, both Jews and non-Jews. And, of course, later in the 1930s, up in 1938 in particular, Nazi laws and edicts tightened the restrictions on firearms ownership, especially by Jews, while at the same time making it easier for Nazi party members and Nazi agents to have guns to carry out their work. So there you had the result of a gun control law that was passed in 1928 having the horrific effects in 1938 and beyond.
Some people may have trouble seeing any connection between the laws of the dictatorial Third Reich and the laws enacted by representatives of the American people. Richard, is it fair to compare Nazi German laws to American laws?
That's a very fair question, too. And look at it this way. If you have a law that operates in a way that disarms the innocent citizen and does not disarm the bad guy, then it's a bad law. Now, true, the Nazi regime had an evil intent. It was a well-known evil intent, as a matter of fact, and they exploited those laws to maximize the power of government agents to hurt innocent people. Now, the same kinds of laws that disarm innocent people in America will endanger and harm the people. But if the government doesn't have evil intentions, well, maybe the damage won't be as great as happened in Nazi Germany. But the problem is, once bad laws get on the books, they're hard to change or repeal. So the best plan is to make sure bad laws never get on the books, and then you can repeal those that are left.
Well, Richard, we all know there have been some other nations that have imposed gun control laws that left people defenseless, disarmed, and set them up for murder. Probably be useful to go through a short list of what those countries are.
Yeah, exactly.
And still are, maybe.
Yeah. Well, in some cases, who knows? The Soviet Union may have been the biggest killer of all. It had basically a prohibition. It had a series of laws that were enacted after the communists took power in 1917. And our book, Death by Gun Control, goes through and shows each additional evolution of the law and how it tightened and further tightened restrictions on private ownership of firearms, such that it got to where you pretty much had to be a party member to have a firearm legally in the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union ended up wiping out 10 or 20 or 30 and some even higher figures, but somewhere between 10 and 20 million of its own citizens who were defenseless in the latter part of the 1930s and early part of the 1940s. Soviet Union then is one of the biggest killers, but we also had Cambodia in the 1970s with their genocide. We had China, history of China, both before and after the communists took power, was one of very stringent so-called gun control. And they had mass murder on a scale that's just unbelievable. Uganda, a small country, had something like 300,000 people of its killed by its own government. Uganda had imported strict so-called gun control laws to be sure that they knew who had firearms and only people really loyal to the regime could have them. Guatemala has something like a 150-year history of so-called gun control laws, and Guatemala has had local persecutions and killings in that very small country. And you can, and a lot of that's owing to the fact that the persecutors were armed and that the victims were not. Most recently, Rwanda, and people have seen the movie Hotel Rwanda. Well, that whole horrific event took place in a land where the defenders were systematically prohibited or discouraged from having firearms for defense. So in Rwanda, the results there were that the aggressors didn't have to have guns because the victims were completely powerless. They were so powerless that the aggressors could use machetes and clubs studded with nails to wipe out people. It was absolutely horrific. In fact, when the defenders, for example, sometimes that there would be an attack in a town and the defenders would run to a church thinking they might have sanctuary there. Well, the attackers didn't respect the church. But if one guy inside the church had a firearm, he could hold off a whole squad or a whole regiment of attacking aggressors until he ran out of bullets. That's how powerful firearm is compared to not having one. And we cover this in great detail in our book, Death by Gun Control, and quite vividly in our documentary, which is Innocence Betrayed. And they go through the genocide and mass murder conducted by governments all over the world.
Yeah, one person mentioned to me that Innocence Betrayed was vivid enough you could almost smell the corpses.
Oh, my.
At any rate, as we wrap this up, there are one or two resources that you would advise listeners to get their hands on to get educated on the subject of the law and how dangerous the law has become. What would those resources be?
Well, sure. Talked about earlier in our conversation today about The Law by Frederick Bastiat. I recommend that. Right after that would be Death by Gun Control or our film Innocence Betrayed. Either one or both of those, they cover slightly different materials. There's a lot of duplication, but then there's different materials in both sources, so there's something for everyone there. Another great book is called The Road to Serfdom, and that's written by Friedrich Hayek. It's a famous book. It's, again, fairly short, and it looks at the issues we've been talking about today from a view of economic policy, but you'll see the same thread of idea running through it. A couple other books on the list I would suggest to people to read. One is Lost Rights by James Bovard, which came out in the early 1990s. And that book, Lost Rights, shows how encroaching federal laws and law enforcement policies are degrading freedom in America in the 90s. Another book by Vin Soprinowitz. You know, easier to search on the name of the book than on the name of the author. But his book is entitled The Ballad of Karl Drega, D-R-E-G-A, Karl Drega. This is a book, a collection of news essays that tell the actual stories of counterproductive laws, oppressive law enforcement in America in the late 1990s and early 2000s. We mentioned also The State versus the People by Claire Wolfe and by you. And that, of course, is practically an encyclopedia of these same things, showing what's actually happening in America and asking the question, how much of this will we tolerate before we start to realize that we're in a police state? I'm not saying we're in there yet, but you can see the kinds of forces that move you toward a police state and kinds of facts that work together. And I would suggest if people could read these resources or watch the film, they'd start to understand about what the law is, the law as a system, and how the law can be perverted to destroy rights, destroy lives. For people who would want to see a fictional account, I really like this new book, Rebel Fire. It's called Rebel Fire, and it's Rebel Fire Out of the Gray Zone, I think is the full title. And it vividly describes a future world that could be there for our grandchildren right here in America if the trends continue. And it's not a book about, you know, guns and firearms and that kind of thing. It's a book about recognizing when you're oppressed and you're not going to take it anymore. And it's a heroic story. I really enjoy that. People can get that at www.rebelfire, R-E-B-E-L-F-I-R-E, rebelfire.com. Those are the resources I would suggest to people.
Richard, I'm going to thank you for being with us today. Richard has been our guest talking about the law. Richard is an attorney and author who has written extensively about freedom and the law. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. And I would like all of you to remember, if you won't defend your rights, then don't complain when you lose them.
Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of JPFO.org or its members. Talkin' to America is a production of JPFO.org.